Hello and welcome to Better Construction with Sean McStay, the podcast where we discuss design and construction techniques, products, and details that lead to a better built environment. Welcome to this week's episode of Better Construction. This week, I'm very lucky to have with me Stephen Basic. Stephen's an architect for many years. I don't need to introduce him to most of you guys. You've seen him on Instagram and on various other media outlets. So Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, welcome. Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's jump in. You know, for the five people in North America who maybe haven't seen you on social media before, maybe introduce yourself real quick.
So like you said, my name's Stephen Basic. I'm a registered architect. I reside here just north of Boston in Massachusetts. I grew up and was raised in Western Mass, Massachusetts. I perform work all over the country, select projects, mostly custom residential. Most of you would know me from, you know, high performance details that I post on Instagram. For those of you that read Green Building Advisor, I was responsible for doing the over 1,000 details for their library. I write normally for Journal Light Construction, Fine Home Building, a bunch of other media outlets, lecture across the country. So in short, you know, I certainly get around. So,
I mean, for me, one of the most interesting questions when I start these podcast episodes off is I'm always curious to find out how people got into our area of work, really, architecture for you specifically. So was architecture kind of always an interest, or did this kind of happen serendipitously?
So it actually kind of fell into place for me. So I before I went to college, I actually did 4 years in the Marine Corps. Hoorah to all my brothers and sisters out there. And got out of the Marine Corps, I worked a number of jobs, and I was actually planning on returning to the Marine Corps as an officer and fly jets, which would have been my number one dream. But I got bitten by the Top Gun bug when I saw the movie. But anyways, I met my lovely wife. She was graduating from the area that we were both living in at the time, moving back to the Boston area. And I said, okay, I'll come back to Boston. And she said, okay, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know, maybe I should look at school and, you know, something to do there. And, you know, what interests you? And architecture did always interest me. I had 4 years of it through high school. We were fortunate that our school actually had drafting and stuff. And the teacher there was superb. That made it really great. So, and it's funny because even now I talk to him on Facebook regularly. So my, you know, freshman high school drafting teacher, he reads all my articles and watches videos and all that stuff. And we communicate regularly, but, you know, I fell into that and I ended up going to an architecture school in Boston and did that for 5 years. But my real big break in the kind of home performance arena was I took a job with Building Science Corporation and was basically their first employee and worked there for right around 10 years. And, you know, it was certainly a privilege working with Betsy and Joe. And the best thing about it is that I was a young architect at the time, so I didn't really have bad habits. I had no habits. So when you have no habits and you're flying on planes with Joe and doing building investigations with Joe and Peter Yost and Coda and Nathan Yost and taking things apart, you get to learn things with a different set of filters that a traditional architect has. And it allows me to see things differently. And, you know, these days as I get older, I'm just trying to share some of that knowledge and pass it on.
Interesting. Yeah. I often do ask my guests, you know, what kind of drew you to the high performance side of construction or design? And it sounds like in your case, you kind of started off there.
Yeah. It's, and I, you know, Peter Yost and I joke, I spent a lot of time with Peter because we travel the country lecturing together, Home Building Crossroads, for those that want to catch up on that. But the interesting conversation we have with Peter is we routinely will pull up a detail on Instagram or something, and it'll be somebody showing a detail of how they're air sealing. And it's like, okay, that's great, but I drew that detail in 96. So don't think you're kind of reinventing the wheel here, but not that I drew everything, but, you know, this stuff has been around for a long time. And, you know, some people think that they're just kind of, you know, reinventing it and bringing it on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the technologies and details and such that are taking off now, you know, they have a route. I mean, I know in Canada in the 70s, it wasn't unheard of to kind of make your own homemade HRVs in the attic. You know, you'd have a way to bring some fresh air in and a way to, you know, pass the outgoing air past it. And, you know, it'd be fans and plywood boxes, but not as advanced as now. But the technology has definitely come back around.
Well, the technology has come around, but even companies like your own, you know, Sega. I mean, where would we be if Sega didn't exist and Sega didn't have their products right now? Our technology level would be, you know, a lot lower. When I was doing energy crafted homes in the, you know, late 90s in Massachusetts with Building Science Corporation, you know, we had the choice of venture tape and venture tape, you know, or an HVAC tape that, you know, you were putting on ductwork that we'd put on a foil face polyiso or something. But nowadays, I mean, you know, you got MyVest and you got all these other products that it just, as an architect, it expands my spectrum of possibilities even more. But more importantly, it allows me to really rethink. And when you have a good understanding of how to put details together and how to prioritize those decisions, you know, having companies like you guys and like Huber, and we can mix these things together and build beautiful walls.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that often when I'm asked with clients, you know, which products do we use, I explain that there's kind of two different levels. There's the very traditional products, which, you know, up here in Canada is the, you know, traditional house wrap, very, very easy to access, you know, and tuck tape and these types of products that weren't really designed for envelopes. And then there's high quality envelope products. Now, Sieg is obviously one of them, and I work there, but there are many others as well that are starting to come into the market that are high performance. Looking at those, I mean, obviously the details are really key when you're picking these products, and you're very into the details. You mentioned that you've, you know, drawn over 1,000 details for Green Building Advisor. Is that something that really fits your personality wise? Are you a very detail oriented person, or do you just feel really strongly that that's the architect's job?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I think it's the architect's job. I mean, one of the things I pride myself on is I tell people I'll never send a set of drawings out of my door without at least one solution, meaning that, you know, we'll meet with framers and he might say, hey, if I cut this way, or, you know, this rafter tail, can I make this slight change? If it maintains the intent, I say, sure. But, you know, I'm not under this naive premise that everything I send out the door has to be built exactly that way. But I never send something out that I tell the framer, hey, you go figure it out. No, I have at least one approach to figure it out. And that's the same with all the details, is that, you know, if we're doing a window install, then I'll have the back dam in, I'll have the slope sill, I'll have everything that I intend to go there. Now, if you want to talk about what material to use to flash that sill later, certainly. But I'm going to start out with the products that I think are the best fit for those different areas, and we're going to adjust from there.
I do hear a lot in the industry and from a few of my guests about integrated design, which is kind of another thing that isn't necessarily a new concept, but is becoming very, very popular right now. What do you think the role is for integrated design insofar as the custom home space where you spend most of your time?
I mean, you know, I've worked with builders that have tried to do that and tried to use a whole bunch of other things to manage the way they do things, workflow, et cetera. You know, for me, I'm a pretty simple guy. And, you know, being from New England, I'll quote Belichick here. It's we all have jobs to do. Just do your job. If everybody did their job on the team, the project goes so smoothly. You know, what happens a lot, and this is my personal pet peeve, is regardless of how you look at any construction project, residential construction project, everybody involved, from the homeowner to the architect to the builder to all of the product manufacturers, we all have a certain level of expectations that we expect. We also have a certain level of expectations that everybody is expecting from us. And when things go south, it's usually because someone didn't do their job. And whether that means that the architect didn't pick the right material to do that job, or the builder value engineered it for some reason with a material that wasn't able to do that job, or the homeowner wasn't willing to pay to do that job. I mean, you want to get me fired up. Let's have that conversation about, hey, how much did that cost a square foot? Because I'm a rocket ship at the launch pad when I hear that question. And because it's, you know, in America, especially in Canada, I would think that you guys probably have a slightly different level of consciousness, but we're willing to spend an enormous amount of money on things that look good and, you know, are really cool when I have my dinner party, but we're sometimes not willing to spend that level of money or budget on the things that make the house last or work good. And then when, you know, someone builds, when I worked at Building Science Corporation, a lot of our work was building investigations. And you'd sit there and say, oh, that must have been really fun. You got to see some really old buildings. No, we were flying to Chicago to see a building that couldn't receive occupancy because it had a water management and mold problem that was not even, you know, turned over to the homeowners yet. It couldn't be because there was mold growing in a crawl space and windows were leaking and issues like that. It's not these old buildings. The old buildings were able to sustain because they were energy pigs, right? But these new buildings that people really don't have a set of good decisions, or they just lack the value and consciousness to make the right decisions, that we build to a pretty embarrassingly low standard in our country overall, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that that's a really big challenge, and it's one that I often ask my guests about because I run into it. And I mean, I spent the early part of my career selling pretty high-end luxury windows and door packages for custom homes. And so that was something that's a little bit more tangible for people. They can see them, they can show them off a little bit. But, you know, looking at the products that I sell now, where we're talking about envelope products, you know, for someone making the decision between going from manufactured stone to natural stone countertops, or going from, you know, an inexpensive envelope to a high performance envelope, you know, we're looking at similar price points in, you know, a typical residential home. When you're talking to your clients about that, how do you kind of walk them through that process to try and get them to lean towards, you know, upgrading things that are more enduring within the building rather than maybe the shorter term things?
I mean, it's a hard conversation. And even for me, I mean, people come to me because they want high performance homes designed, et cetera. And so they realize, and you know, you get the comments, I'll post something on Instagram or I'll do a video with Matt Reisinger for his YouTube channel. And the minute you start talking about money, people say, oh, well, we built for $100 a square foot down here. And then I'll have to go online there and I say, listen, you might think we're the criminal because we charge $250 a square foot, but you're the criminal at the $100 a square foot, right? Because let's talk about what costs money, because I have really good experience with what costs money, right? You're building a new $5 million home. You install all these beautiful windows. The tape gets value engineered out. The flashing gets value engineered out. So in the first year, you have a number of windows as the homeowner that leak. So now you know the windows leak, but no, we have to pay a company to come out that has forensic engineers to take the window apart and take a look at it to tell you what. Oh, the window's leaking. Well, you know that because there's water there, but you just dropped another $5,000 to get these guys to have their opinion. Now you have to take their opinion and you have to put it in paper because your lawyer has to send it to their lawyer. And to put that opinion on paper is probably another $5,000. So then you have to pull the window, you have to reinstall it, and oh, guess what? You're going to reinstall it the right way now, right? So there's a lot of people, I'm sure you've seen it on Instagram, I post it. You know, there's two ways to do things, the right way and again. So now you're into it for, you know, 10 plus grand. Your lawyers are battling. This is taking forever. The builder doesn't want to deal with this. And how did we get there? We saved $300 on tape and flashing. Right? That's how we got there. So, you know, when you're trying to make these conscious decisions, those are the kind of conversations I have with the homeowner. It's like, okay, there's some areas I can compromise, but there's some areas that have absolutely no compromise. And if they have no compromise and you still want to do it, then you as the homeowner are going to take, you know, all the blame on that one, because I'll draw it that way, but you're going to sign this and say that this is the way that you wanted it done, right? Because I don't agree with that. And the same with builders. I say, listen, we got to find that extra $300 or something. We can't. I mean, if you're building a $10 million house, then the $300 probably didn't make a difference. But it's really about educating your client. I mean, clients know at any level. They understand value because they've all shopped for a house. They've all shopped for a car. They've all shopped for commodity items. So when they go into a Target and they say, oh, should I buy this car seat or that car seat? They look at it. They try and get some kind of value judgment. They don't just walk in and say, oh, I'm going to buy that one because that's the cheapest, right? They look at it. So why do we not do that when it comes to a house? It's like, oh, you need a house wrap. Well, here's one for, I don't know, 5 cents a square foot. Well, it's not the 10 cent a square foot house wrap that was suggested, but I can save a few bucks. And hey, it's all just house wrap, right? No, it isn't.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I had a customer that I did a walkthrough of their project, and they were going for a pretty low air tightness number in BC, a step 4 air tightness, so 1.5 air changes an hour. And they started off by thinking they're going to use their typical house wrap product and some typical tape, and they'll just be really detailed with it. And then they did a blower door test that didn't work. So then they tried to do an interior air barrier that was very difficult to execute after the fact. So then they tried taping insulation and on, and eventually they had to use a spray and air barrier product. So at the end of the day, they spent honestly about $19,000 to try and get that house airtight. The price difference between going from what they used, the kind of construction grade wrap on the outside, to a high performance wrap would have been $3,000 at the beginning. And it was a very large house. But it's unfortunately something we see often in our market. As an architect, do you feel like I run into a lot of architects that say they don't specify products. They'll specify maybe a performance level, and then it's up to an engineer or a builder to pick the products. Do you feel that that's maybe not the best approach?
Yeah, I mean, I have somewhat of a mixed approach. When I know I want a specific product, then I will say, let's use that specific product, and that'll be in my details, and it'll be called out by its name, model number, or whatever the case is. In some areas, I might not have as much of a reason to choose this over that, and so I'm good with it. For example, if we were doing a metal roof and I wanted to put a high temperature adhered membrane under the roof, I mean, there's a Henry product that's a good product. There's, Grace makes a good product, et cetera, that I'm happy with any of those interchanging. But for example, when it comes to windows, I like your guys's product, right? And I specify Sega, and that's what I say. And I go to the, I try and make it easier on the builder, that I kind of circumvent his decision-making process, because what I'll do is I just take my drawings, I send them to Ken, CC the builder, and say, Ken, we need a tape quote on this, and I'll send the window schedule. And then Ken just literally sends it, and then the builder now has this, and he says, okay, $760, we put that into the budget as window taping. And there you go. So I don't even play around with letting them shop. I'll do the shopping for them, because I'm already tied into that network. It's that kind of expectations thing. And it's like, if the builder says something and says, oh my God, look at the price, I say, listen, I just saved you $100 in labor for you. You didn't have to do any shopping or looking for anything, right? I just did all your work for you. All you did is took a number. You got to plug it in your spreadsheet now.
All right. So switching gears a little bit, I want to talk to you a little bit about your design process. So someone comes to you looking to build a custom home. How does that initial conversation go? What type of thoughts and ideas should that person have coming into that conversation with you?
So that's really interesting, because I probably have an approach that's somewhat similar to others, but over 27 years, it's still in development, let's say. But it the process I have, I'm very happy with. I think it works very well. But the homeowners come, they sit down. So the first thing is a phone call. And when I have that phone call, I let them know and acknowledge right from the get-go that this is a mutual interview. I know you're calling me because you think you want me to design your house, but I have had clients that I said I was not interested in designing for them because their level of consciousness and what they want to do, or there's a whole bunch of red flags that can pop up in the initial process that make me go, And one of the things that I've really learned, you know, and I learned this pretty early on, but if I don't have a good relationship on day one or day two, what the hell does that relationship look like on day 300, right? Because we should be, on day one, we should have the cheerleaders out and be happy as hell that we're designing a house and be totally into it and excited. And, you know, sometimes you don't get that. And I just say, maybe this isn't the right feel. Or, you know, I've had clients that, you know, you tell them that it's not the right feel, then they call back. They try and say, you know, oh, well, you know, I took what you said and I don't think that's true. And I say, listen, the only thing worse than a client that is a red flag at the beginning is one that's trying to talk themselves out of being a red flag, because then they really understand that I that kind of confirms my decision in most cases. It very rarely reverses it. So then we end up with a client, say that we mutually agree, like, hey, this is a great idea. I sent him a design agreement. It's a small little 5-pager, but it outlines all the expectations of them and me. And if they sign that and sign up and we design the house, then the next email is an email of what I call client homework. And that's probably about 6 tabs of work. I ask them all to write a narrative. And the narrative is such that I don't want to hear about how you want a 20-foot by 20-foot family room because your sister's is 18 foot and you think that it could be 2 foot bigger. I want the narrative in the sense that I want to know what makes a successful house for you, right? Because I'll give you an example. We can look at the kitchen. I have clients that think that they're gourmet chefs and they want the kitchen that dreams are made of. And then I've had clients that say, you know, the biggest thing in the kitchen for us is the microwave because we make 90% of our meals out of that. Well, those are two totally different kitchens. Even if they're in the same $1 million house, they're two totally different kitchens. And the same with family rooms, right? Are you the kind of family that entertains and every family party is at your house? Or are you the homebodies where it's you and your husband and the kids, you know, crawl up on the couch and watch Frozen or something on a Friday night and relax, right? Those are two different types of family rooms and attitudes. So, and the other thing that's really important about the narrative is, as a designer, if I just walk away and design and come back and say, hey, here's you know, some initial floor plans and elevations, then you run the risk of having homeowners say, well, that's not anything like what we talked about or what, you know, any of that. And so you give them an out. And so that whole expectations thing, by making them write a narrative, and I also ask that the husband and wife each send at least 5 pictures of an exterior and an interior that they like, and just some comments on what makes that picture appealing or intriguing to you. And it's not that I'm taking those and copying them. What I'm trying to do is take a mile wide goalpost and narrow it to a couple hundred feet, right? Because it doesn't make sense of doing kind of a Miami modern if they're looking for a Craftsman bungalow, right? So somehow we need to narrow that down. But more importantly, the minute I get that homework back, now I have 10 pages in writing from them and pictures, so that when I send that first floor plan out and they say, oh, wow, this is nothing we talked about. Well, let's review what we talked about, because your narrative here says this, this, and this. And that's where, you know, I was deriving this from. And that conversation very rarely comes up because we manage the expectations right from the get-go. That I take the design question that is posed to me and basically flip it on the homeowners and say, okay, what do you think is a successful house? And I tell people that I'm more of a coach than I am the guy that goes away, comes back and says, hey, this is how you should do it. It's more of coming back and say, okay, based on your comments and your thoughts, this is how I think that relationship to the kitchen and family room and dining space should be, or to the outside space or the pool or whatever it is in the narrative. And the other thing I always ask is, I tell it jokingly, but I tell the husband, you know, and the wife that they need to do their homework. They need to do it separately, not show each other or influence each other until after they send it to me. And I jokingly tell the husband, I said, this is your one chance to speak honestly. That always gets a joke. And then we start the design. And through the design process, I ask three things of my clients. And I ask them in a very specific order, that they be honest, they be confident, and then they be expedient. Everybody, in today's world, everybody wants things tomorrow, right? People think they can send me an email tonight and they get revised drawings tomorrow. Well, that's not really the world we live in. But what we don't want to happen is to get to the third or fourth design meeting and have somebody say, you know, I didn't want to say anything, but I really don't even like the kitchen over there. And it's like, oh, well, why didn't you say something? Well, you seem to really like it, and I didn't want to, you know, hurt your feelings. It's like, this isn't my house. I'm a big boy. There's probably, you know, half the decisions you're going to make in this house that I like, but I wouldn't do, right? Because that's, if I were to do them, then it would be my house, not your house. And so they should be different. But be honest and be confident and then be expedient. Don't do things. Say, you know, you get the one client where you send them a question and, you know, I think they have a stopwatch there on their response time and they track it. And it's not always the best thing that I tell home. Even if I send something on Friday, it's like, listen, I'm not going to touch this until next Monday or Tuesday. Take the time to think about it. Look at it tomorrow. Put it on the shelf. Pull it off the shelf Sunday night. Take another look at it. Have a conversation with your wife. And then email me a response next Tuesday. But take some time. This is a house, you know, it's we talk about performance, but also from the design aspect, this is a house that we're taking all these resources, we're putting them together to build this thing we call a home. It's going to sit there for 50, 100, 200 years, depending on who, how you put it together. And we want to make good decisions. Don't make these fly-by-night decisions.
That's really interesting. That, from a design standpoint, that's very, very customer focused. I always am curious with designers, especially architects like yourself that have been doing this for quite some time. How much, what kind of percentage do you weight, obviously for you, quite highly for the customer's design input versus your own personal style and also paying attention to local design? Because you work all across the country and obviously, you know, fitting into a neighborhood or fitting into a local style is something to think about.
Right. Well, even when I work, you know, from in different locations around the country, part of my requirements, you know, we talked about that initial phone call meeting, but, you know, I usually don't start a project until I have a chance to meet the homeowners in person and walk their job site. You know, part of that is the due diligence, but the other part is, you know, you wake up at the hotel room, you know, 7, 8 o'clock that morning, the meeting's at 10 o'clock. I'll drive through a few neighborhoods and kind of get the flavor of what's local out there. You know, it's certainly not that hard to get that information. And we're probably more eclectic now in our design sense than we've ever been in history. So it's not a bad thing. But yeah, I mean, it is somewhat client focused. And it's, you know, one of the things that's a little discouraging to me, you know, you get things like Instagram and social media and all these things. It's when you get information is kind of a two-edged blade, right? That you have the potential to get really good information quickly that, you know, on Instagram, you can talk to a Mike Girton and get an answer on something that he's probably failed at 10 times and then has solved the next 30 times. Right. But he's done it 10 different ways and you're going to get his best way of doing it for the last 20 years. And but the downfall of it is you get to see some god awful stuff or misinformation. And I think, you know, some people use social media as, can I put up, you know, the next greatest finished picture of the way to do a set of stairs? You know, or, you know, the kitchen island, how we trim that out. And I'm not saying that innovation is a bad thing or, you know, thinking out of the box is a bad thing. But what I am saying is, as a designer, when you walk through one of my projects, you'll get a sense that there was one person driving the boat that had a sense of how to knit this all together. So I look at the projects as kind of a giant quilt, and the living room is this patch and the bedrooms are this these patches and kitchen is this patch. And it's my job to kind of be that maestro and kind of create that harmony. in the package so that it looks like it. So you don't walk in the kitchen and say, oh my God, did they just blow all the budget on that fancy island and, you know, kitchen faucet? And then you walk in the rest of the house and it's like, huh, what happened here? This doesn't even look like it belongs to that house. But someone found some great picture somewhere on Pinterest and wanted to duplicate that island and add cable rail to it and all this fancy stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's okay. It does. I'll give you, when you post that Instagram post, people are going to look at it and go, oh, wow. But here's the thought. Take that Instagram post, repost it in 5 years and see what they think.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I think a lot of that other conversation we were talking about having with homeowners of talking about interior finishes and things they can see and touch versus the envelope and you know, windows and insulation and stuff, that conversation comes too. You're going to remodel that kitchen in 15 or 20 years, maybe even sooner. You're not going to be swapping out insulation and envelope materials in 15 or 20 years, hopefully, all going well.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's, you know, I worked with a production home builder in the Southwest, and they were one of the largest privately held ones down there. And the dad at the time was the owner. And in his basic philosophy is that I'm going to build a damn good house for the things that we're not going to change in the next 50 years and make sure that we make those right choices. And then from there, we'll extend to a kind of a second tier of decisions that, okay, yeah, countertops, we might end up swapping those out in 10, 15, 20 years. But like you said, you're not pulling the windows out in the next 50 years. And it's frustrating. You know, like I said, Peter Yost and I traveling around the country, when we go to do our lectures, it's very much like client visits for me. We'll fly in, you know, the day before we're lecturing in Houston or Denver or whatever, and we'll usually either try and hook up with somebody we know in the area that's one of the reps for one of the manufacturing companies that we know or whatever, but we always try and get some tours. And so we go around and see what the local building culture is like. And man, I've toured some $4 or $5 million houses that have the cheapest windows in them. And the only thing that I can do is walk away from there and say, listen, I mean, not only is this a bad decision, but think about it. The minute we turn a house over to a client for occupancy, it initializes a state of decay, right? The house is never going to get better from that point. It's going downhill, right? We kick it over the hill. The question is how steep is that hill? And, you know, some of these houses that I see getting built in some of these cities, it's not even a hill. It's more like a cliff. Like you're kicking the rock over and man, it's falling straight down really quick.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've seen some interesting homes, you know, like 18,000 square foot luxury home, probably $12 million construction costs, and they've got pin punched garbage bag material building wrap on the outside of it. And you're just like, okay, this was not thought through.
Yeah. And they're a hard client. And here's the real kicker is the person writing that check doesn't have the education to understand that that was a bad decision.
Exactly.
That's the scary thing, that there's this kind of link in between that as builder and architect, you can either take the responsibility to educate your clients and educate them the right way, or you can be the builder and architect that kind of holds them at bay and just tells them that, yeah, we know how to do this. We'll take care of it. And they'll do exactly what you said.
So with that in mind, you wear a lot of different hats. You know, obviously designer and architect is one that we've been talking about, but you also do a lot of public speaking. What drew you to that, or are you drawn to that, or, you know, kind of what started your process in doing some of these public speaking events and series now that you do?
Well, I mean, when you worked at Building Science Corporation, you know, Joe pretty much spent his life traveling around delivering the building science message. So it's hard to work there and not become part of some conference, whether it was EBA or, you know, the BSA conference here in Boston, or whatever local conferences there are. But when you tend to do something that's slightly out of the box or above the norm, then you tend to want to, you know, express that or get that information out. It does a couple things, believe it or not. one, if I stayed home and harbored all of the information and never wrote an article and never shared this information, yeah, okay, I'd be doing good projects and stuff. But it would never really force me to become better, right? So the minute I do a video and say, hey, this is how we built this really cool wall and this and that, well, then I can put that behind me and I'm on to thinking, how do I improve that wall? So there is this kind of understanding of self-motivation that if you release all the information that you have to help all the others, then what it forces you to do is help yourself to become even better. And, you know, that's how I look at it, that, you know, hey, I'll share all this information. I'll probably never build the wall that way again. I will improve it somehow. Because if I don't, then I'm really not doing my job, right?
Gotcha. So with that in mind as well, you guys, I know you're also in the process right now of starting up a podcast. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of information avenues out there. I mean, you have this fine podcast here that we're going to reach a whole bunch of people and talk about it. But Jake Bruton, who's a builder in Missouri that I do a bunch of work with, you know, he came to me with the idea and said, hey, why don't we grab you and grab Peter Yost and we can start a podcast. And, you know, when we really started thinking about it, one of the things that our industry lacks is this ability to really make sound decisions and everything that we just talked about, right? How do I, as a builder or an architect, what kind of materials do I choose? What should I be using here? What's the best product for that detail? Or how do you even detail that? Or should I care about it? What do I care about? What do I place the highest value on? What really doesn't matter? Because again, with that double blade sword that I spoke about, information, I see a lot of things on Instagram where people put something out there and be like, oh, look at this detail. This is great. It's like, yeah, that's okay. But that's like the 50th thing I would worry about on a house, right? It's not in that top 10 list. So how do we prioritize that? So the three of us, when you really look at it, you have Peter Yost, who's a very well-known building scientist, building investigator, lecturer, et cetera. And Peter knows so much information. I mean, I always joke with him about how he puts me to sleep, but I don't know many more people that understand building and material properties and those kinds of things better than Peter. I mean, when I have a question, he's usually my first phone call. Of, hey, what's the perm rating on this? Or what do I do here? And he's like, I just told you that last month. I go, I know, but I didn't write it down. So I got to get it again from you. But we have him, we have myself speaking from the architecture design point of view. And then we have Jake talking from the builder's point of view. And when you think about it for a second, you know, you have the guy that the architect that has the design and inception of the project, and how does he deliver that and develop it, work with the clients to come to bring an idea to the table that then gets handed off to a builder who then has to apply numbers to it and actually build it right. And then you have someone like Peter who is involved with builders and architects from pre-construction, but he also does a lot of building investigations. So he gets to see where materials fail and installations and executions have failed. So when you think about, hey, the spectrum of opportunity to hear from people about experiences, and, you know, Jake's on the younger side, but Peter and I are no spring chickens and we've been around a while. So not only do you have the spectrum of, you know, what we do, but you also, between Peter and I, probably have 60 plus years of experience in the construction industry. So, you know, we labeled it the Unbuild It podcast. And the whole idea behind the Unbuild It is because of the three of us and the series of filters that we have, we're able to take concepts and break them down and analyze them at very simple components and talk about those and then put those components back together to assemblies, et cetera, and talk about how they perform. But basically taking buildings apart and taking a look at it, right?
Okay, that's actually a really interesting format. And will you be taking questions from, social media in different places, or
Yeah,
how
we
are
have
you?
a Unbuild It has its own Instagram handle, and I believe we do have a website that'll have an email, and we encourage our listeners to write in and say, hey, I'm working on this house, or I have these questions, blah, blah, blah. And if we feel like it's the right question at the right time, then we can put it together and we can come up for an answer for you.
Well, that sounds very interesting for sure. I'll make sure to put a link in the description for that. Another thing that I know you've recently started working on, and I've actually had the good fortune to spend two trips with Matt Reisinger, one in Switzerland and one in Vancouver, working on the Build Show with him. And I see that you're now obviously involved with the Build Show Network. So maybe talk us through a little bit what you're doing there.
Yeah, that whole trip to Switzerland, by the way, is a little pet peeve of mine because that was supposed to be my spot and I couldn't go on it because of a previous engagement. And then they said, oh, well, just ask Matt to go. And Matt went on the trip. But yeah, I mean, Matt has become a really good friend. I'm helping him on his remodel and developed a bunch of details on his own personal house there in Austin. But he's an outlet to get good information. I mean, he's trying to do the right thing. You can look at people like him and others as however you want, but the reality is Matt has a genuine heart. He's trying to really help the industry understand how bad, some of it really is, and how can we do this better, and how can we make these decisions. And so whenever he's up in the Northeast, I usually get a phone call, couple of weeks ahead of time saying, hey, I'm going to be up here on Tuesday the 12th. And do you have anything to go look at? And I usually have something that we can go and create a video on for his YouTube channel. Or, with me being part of the Build Show Network, you have myself, Jake, Wade, and Brent Hull. That, again, is a pretty wide spectrum of understanding of building, right? Jake is doing a bunch of high performance stuff. Wade does some beautiful luxury stuff down there on the Rhode Island coast, and you have Brent, who just fascinates me with his historical perspective on everything and that he does. And then myself, that I do a little hodgepodge of everything: high performance design, some cool stuff, and talk about how we get it all together. But yeah, the Build Show Network, I think, is again, it's one of these great outlets that has the opportunity to kind of bring information. And the thing that I really like about it, we had a day-long conference, like everybody that was involved in the Build Show Network last week. You might remember my post. That's where they voted me the sexiest guy in the industry. But that was for Awesome Framers. But more importantly, a couple of things that we talked about. The beauty of the Build Show Network is a lot of it's raw stuff, right? They're beautiful videos and they're done well, but these aren't these high polished HGTV kind of scenarios. This is a bunch of guys that are talking about what I did yesterday. I mean, the videos of the ceilings or the recent videos that I put up, these were conversations that I had with the builder the day before, right? You're getting real time, real things. This isn't me polishing something or creating a drawing or detail to show you how cool this is. No, this is me every day, where the Build Show Network is just giving you kind of a couple slices of that so that you can look at how you do things. And you're going to, when you compare them, you're going to come to one of two outcomes. You're going to say, or three outcomes. You're going to say, I'm doing it better than they are, so I'm good. I'm doing it the same way they're doing it, so I'm good. Or, wow, I got a little thing here to learn, and I got to listen a little bit better and maybe up my game, and this is how we do it. So, any way you slice it, the outcome at the end of the day is we all become better for it. Right? Because even when I do those videos, when you have to sit there and think about how to explain something, or even on a podcast, I'm going to walk away from here going, I'm going to have 5 or 10 things that I'm going to walk away from here saying, I should really think about how I do this a little bit better, because now I had the chance to talk about it and, I can maybe improve on that.
Yeah, I think it's really important for everyone to kind of take that in very strongly. I mean, in the industry, typically in the past, you know, you do your apprenticeship, and then from then on, your education is really kind of determined a little bit by who you get to work with. And some people are very fortunate; they get to work with some very great people that they can learn from. Other people maybe are working on projects that are not being done the best way possible. But I think now with things like the Build Show Network, like your guys' podcast, hopefully this podcast. And other things, YouTube, online, really, people are getting a wider breadth of knowledge. They can go out and more easily find these kind of mentors and find these tips and tricks that maybe they wouldn't have been able to just in their little local experience in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't all pretty pictures. I don't know how much you got to see, but my first couple of videos for the Build Show Network was basically sitting at a table. I took some drawings and my big red pen marker. And I simply talked about, when I look at a detail, what do I see? And tried to relay that information, because I guarantee there's a lot of people out there that would look at that detail and they don't see it the same way. And they shouldn't. My experience, my set of filters have been developed based on certain experiences. And unless you've experienced them exactly like I have, the outcome isn't going to be the same. So the more information that we can share, you know, the better we all are. You know, I'm one of these guys that I love to throw out quotes and stuff, but I tell people we're all on a learning curve. We're just in different seats, right? You know, people say, oh, I wish I knew as much as you did. Well, believe it or not, it's every time I figure something out, all I've really done is opened a door to a hallway with 10 more doors, right? You'd never figure it out, because if you figured it out, if you stop, then you're really not doing your job. So, you know, you open that door, it just leads to a hallway with 10 more doors that now I have to open. And guess what's on the other side of those 10 doors, right? Just more hallways. So there's always some next level of understanding that we can strive for.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, SIGA, the company that I work for, you know, we have a vision of a world of zero energy loss buildings, but internally we have a motto that the way we do things today is the worst possible way to do it. We're always improving, always learning new things. There's always one step further we can go to try and improve things. So I think that's 100% true. Towards the end of these podcasts, I always ask my guests two questions. So I'm going to ask you those now. The first one is, if you had a magic wand or just the ability to fix any one misconception about better construction, which one would it be?
I think we need to really develop a good set of values that we base decisions on, because I don't think we're there. You know, people always ask me what's the best material for this, and what should I use here? And I tell them the one that's installed right, and the one that's used properly is usually the case. But I'm always amazed. It's like I will do a set of drawings, have a chat with a new builder, and they're like, "What's this EPS?" I'm like, "Oh, that's the rigid foam. Oh, that's not that blue stuff." It's like, how have you been building for 20 years and you don't understand the difference between EPS, XPS, or polyiso? I get it. There's it's not only just one person. The industry is like that. Then I think that's not kind of an insult to any one particular builder or contractor by any means, because there was a day where I didn't understand the difference between EPS, XPS, and polyiso, but you know, hopefully that was, you know, year one, not year 20. But what it shows is our lack of understanding in the industry, and that we really need to we all need to up our game and figure this out and understand. And instead of just saying we're going to do this or do that, one of the things, you know, occasionally I'll work with new builders, and it's somewhat telling. You know, you break out the set of drawings and you ask a couple questions and they like roll their eyes. Like, listen, everything that we do here today is important to this build. You know, when I see the eyes roll, that just tells me it's like, you know, we might not be getting the commitment that this house deserves. And it's funny. If you don't want to be a builder, then don't be one. Go do something else. But don't come and be a half-assed builder, right? If you want to be a builder, be a builder. Do your job, just like architects. If you want to be an architect, do your job, right? And your job might mean figuring out that detail, not sending the drawings. I mean, someone on Instagram posted today a roof framing plan. They had absolutely no notes or anything. And the builder was like, well, what do I, or he was an estimator. He's like, what am I supposed to do with this? Exactly. Right. That's a good example of here. This estimator for a lumber yard has certain expectations. Well, he expects a certain level of information so that he can do his job. And if that information doesn't come across the table, then he's not able to do his job. And now, you know, that how does that project succeed? Right.
Exactly. So the second question that I normally ask at the end of these is, because I love books, I have a huge collection of books, and it's growing probably faster than my wife would like it to. If you could recommend a book to somebody, could be to do with architecture and building, could be just not anything to do with what we've been talking about, what book would you recommend?
So it's funny because I have tons of books like you do. I like to read, and it's funny because I don't read a lot of books on building necessarily. I read books on how to do things. And like right now, I'll throw this one out. It's called The One Thing. I forget the name of the author, but he talks about, you know, pick one thing and become really good at it instead of trying to do everything. And it's kind of, it gets back to my, you know, in Belichick's, do your job, right? If you're a wide receiver, then don't worry about trying to be a running back. Be a wide receiver, be the best wide receiver you can be. Well, if you're a builder, or an architect, be the best builder or architect you can be and do your job. But as far as building books, I'm going to go down the Brent Hull highway here. I love to, I have a collection of old architectural graphic standards, like volume one, volume two, and that, not the most recent volumes. And the reason for that is the one thing that you have the ability to do sitting here in year 2020 is look at these hand-drawn books from the 50s or 60s and say, you know, some of that stuff still holds true, right? The way they designed joinery in those days, you know, builders will talk about a lock miter joint or this or that to really hold this tight. Well, you guys didn't really invent that. That, you know, they were doing stair treads and risers and locking them in 70, 80, 100 years ago. So it's not new. So I like to look at the old books and then kind of reflect on the connection between where they were and where we are now and try to understand. And when I understand that, then I can understand, is there a natural progression here now that we have materials that they don't have, right? Like SIGA or, you know, the tapes and membranes, is there a way that we can improve things even further now? But you really have to get in that mindset of understanding that natural progression and innovation of how things developed to a certain point and how did we get here? And we can't understand how we got here unless we understand where we were. And that'll help us define where we go.
Yeah, that's very powerful and a very interesting sounding suggestion. So I'm sure a lot of the listeners will be interested to try and find those and pick them up. Well, Stephen, thank you very much for being on the show. For the listeners, I'm going to be putting links to all of Stephen's social media, Build Show Network, and their podcast as well in the description for the show and with the posts. And with that, Stephen, I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Sean, it was actually a privilege. Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to come out here and talk with you. Hopefully we can do it again sometime soon.
Yeah, I agree. That'd be great. Thanks.
All righty.